You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Now, here's the February 2018 cover story, Being Blunt. They don't come more talented or tough-minded than Emily Blunt, but even she was initially daunted by the title role in Mary Poppins Returns, out next Christmas. The 34-year-old British actress and mother of two talks to Julie Miller about her spin on the iconic nanny, her social media skepticism, and her most recent challenge, In a Quiet Place, directed by her husband and co-star John Krasinski. Photographs for this article are by Craig McDean, styled by Jessica Deal. Opening photo, lounge act, Emily Blunt, photographed at the Lotte New York Palace Hotel. And in these photographs, Emily Blunt wears various high fashion items and looks gorgeous. Emily Blunt has sparred with Meryl Streep twice, out-action starred Tom Cruise, and ruled the British Empire on screen. But on this blustery Brooklyn afternoon in November, the 34-year-old English-born actress, surprisingly delicate in person, given the strength she projects on film, is perched on a window seat in a Cobble Hill cafe, laughing about her first professional heartbreak. Blunt was 18 and playing Judy Dench's granddaughter in the 2001 West End production of The Royal Family. If this scenario sounds ludicrously heaven-sent, know that Blunt is the first to admit it. She never intended to act professionally. The hobby was an antidote to a childhood stutter. But there she was. Blunt, who was still living with her parents in London, had no formal training. And Dench, fresh off her Shakespeare in Love Oscar win, had kindly taken her under her wing. I was a kid and could have meant nothing to her, but every day after work, she invited me to her dressing room, says Blunt, giddily recalling backstage visits from Johnny Depp and Pierce Brosnan. It was crazy to me. I was drinking champagne and pretending I knew what anyone was talking about. When the royal family came to its close, Blunt remembers weeping on the last day, like embarrassingly scream-crying. I was so sad it was ending. I had wrapped gifts for everyone. I think I made people gift bags with whatever I could afford, and I was like, we should meet up, we should have lunch. Poor Emily, says Dench, chuckling when relayed the story. It wasn't a great play, but we had the most fun doing it. I think she was quite young and frightened and insecure when we did The Royal Family. Even then, though, Dench sensed in Blunt the tools to survive a notoriously brutal business. You kind of know with somebody's attitude, says Dench. She has a great sense of humor, which is more important than anything. A huge talent, and was ravishingly pretty. My grandson was about 6, and he fell for Emily in such a big way. Now, whenever we see Emily, he is 20 now, he jokes, she'd never have gotten where she was if I hadn't kissed her. It doesn't surprise me at all where she is. I am thrilled that she is a big, beautiful star. Bundled up in a parka and knit hat, Blunt arrived at the Brooklyn Cafe alone, having walked from the nearby home she rents with her husband, John Krasinski, and their daughters, Hazel, 3, and Violet, 1. She greeted me as she might an old friend, extending her arms and saying, "Now, get in here for a nice cold hug." Sitting down, she ordered an English tea, with what felt like a touch of skepticism that the American cafe would get it right. As of 2015, Blunt is a dual citizen of the U.S. and the U.K., but that doesn't mean she has to put up with mediocre tea. After the first cup, she switches to hot water. Blunt speaks with patrician diction and is a gifted mimic who punctuates stories with effortless impressions. Later, when helpfully directing me to a subway station, she'll note, "In Fluent Valley Girl, perfect, it's right next to Soul Cycle." Blunt laughs easily and often. "She has one of the best laughs I've ever heard," says friend and two-time co-star Benicio del Toro, like while recounting the story of how, as an infant, she thrust her partially decaying stuffed animal under the Queen Mum's nose for a good smell at a royal event to which her grandfather, a World War II major general, was invited. Equipped with a polite response for every social circumstance, the royal replied, "Oh yes, I see that he is very well loved." Blunt's large, pale blue eyes are watery, and her cheeks are still rosy from the cold. Though her delicate facial features would look at home on an 18th-century oil painting, her casual dress, black silk blouse and skinny pants, and slight build camouflage her among the brunching Brooklyn hipsters. Or, as she puts it, with a glint in her eye and a fleeting American accent, "I blend in real well." That ability has been a key to her success. She has slid through a kaleidoscope of mesmerizing characters over the past 16 years, most notably an enigmatic schoolgirl, My Summer of Love, an acerbic fashion assistant, The Devil Wears Prada, an ass-kicking combat warrior, Edge of Tomorrow, a barren Sondheim-singing baker's wife, Into the Woods, an in-over-her-head FBI agent, Sicario, and a blackout drunk, the girl on the train. It's only after Blunt lets loose another peal of laughter that a fellow diner notices her and attempts to snap a photo. "Except for right now," Blunt adds, moving to my side of the table and pulling a chair in close. Usually it's Krasinski, who starred as everyman Jim Halpert on the American version of The Office, whom strangers recognize in public. "John is, like, 6'3", and was playing the most approachable man in the world," she tells me. "So people will be like Jim." Guys want to high-five him. "Speaking about the strangeness of acting celebrity," she says, "I am always under the impression that I have a silly job for a living. But occasionally, you will run into someone who deepens your feeling about it. Sometimes people will say they had cancer, and The Office was the only thing that made their family laugh during that time. You realize when you are in something that really touches people that it does offer an escape." Blunt recently relocated her family from Los Angeles to Brooklyn because she missed the intimacy of brushing past strangers on the street and being in a vibrant, bustling city where you don't feel isolated. The tech age has presented her with a challenge, though, given her friendly nature. Social media has changed the landscape, so an encounter with you is valued more as a social media currency than a genuine interaction, says Blunt, explaining that she has adopted a selfie-combating strategy when approached while with her young children. Frances McDormand told us, "She just makes my teeth ache. I love her so much. When someone asks her for a picture," she says, "You know what? I've actually retired from that, but I would like to shake your hand and meet you." As her star has risen, Blunt has been encouraged to establish a social media presence herself, but she has no interest in tilting the delicate balance she has found as a movie star with character actor range, high profile enough to carry studio films, yet low profile enough for audiences to believe her as everything from a magical nanny to a bloated binge drinker. Speaking about social media, Blunt says, "I don't think it does shit, to be honest. I think a movie lives or dies on word of mouth and the trailer. I have seen people do endless social media campaigns, and the movie tanks, so I don't see a correlation. I strongly believe that my job is to persuade you that I am playing somebody else. So exposing too much personally is just something I can't get on board with. Blunt is so private, in fact, that her own husband did not even know she could sing until she was filming Rob Marshall's adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's Tony-winning musical Into the Woods. "I had literally never heard her sing a note," says Krasinski, who was convinced that both he and Blunt were at the same level of singing talent, which is low mediocre. When she signed on, Krasinski says, "I thought that was such a cool gig, but to be honest, I was really nervous for her." Months later, Krasinski stopped by an Into the Woods recording session, complete with an orchestra. Marshall told Krasinski that he had arrived just in time to see Emily sing, saying, "She's so good." "I don't actually know if she is," Krasinski responded. "I've never heard her sing." "He looked at me as if the earth had just opened up in front of him," Krasinski remembers. "His mouth was wide open. He did not say anything. He just turned to the window, cued the song, the orchestra started playing, and Emily started singing, and I just immediately wept." "It was really wild. It was like finding out that your wife can levitate," he adds. "It was just like, when were you going to tell me this?" Marshall first noticed Blunt, as most American moviegoers did, in the 2006 comedy The Devil Wears Prada, where she brought sensitivity to her supporting role as the tortured assistant of Meryl Streep's fashion editrix. "She reminded me immediately of a young Maggie Smith," recalls Marshall, "because of the humor, the acting chops, the vulnerability. I see her having an incredibly long career because of the uniqueness of her extraordinary talent. It transcends beauty and looks and age." Marshall directs Blunt again in what is her most high-profile role yet, succeeding Julie Andrews as Mary Poppins in Disney's Mary Poppins Returns, out next Christmas. Marshall says Blunt was his first and only pick to play the beloved P.L. Travers character. The role required her to undergo dance training with her co-stars. When filming began, Blunt, who doesn't see fear when it comes to challenges, according to Marshall, shot the most difficult number first. A 15-minute choreographed song and dance sequence alongside co-star Lin-Manuel Miranda, children and small male dancers in green screen costumes. Blunt teases with a smile, "Penguins might make an appearance." "Rob's just so incredibly kind and sweet," says Blunt. "He creates such a joyful atmosphere that you think, oh, eff it, I'll try to dance." Blunt seems to be devoid of ego and neurosis, a trait helped by her happy upbringing as the second of four children in a tight-knit family. Her father, a criminal defense lawyer who represented some of the robbers in the Millennium Dome raid, and her mother, a former theater actress who teaches English as a second language, raised the family in the leafy London suburb of Roehampton. Older sister Felicity, who is married to Blunt's Devil Wears Prada co-star Stanley Tucci, is a literary agent. Younger sister Susanna is a veterinarian, and younger brother Sebastian is an actor and writer. Blunt remembers growing up as an imaginative tomboy who eschewed pink clothing, played football, and delighted in play-acting elaborate hamster rescues. It was only after Blunt developed a stutter as a child that a teacher suggested acting as an exercise. Years later, during a summer off from boarding school in Surrey, Blunt was discovered by an agent who saw her perform at the Edinburgh International Festival, derailing her plans to go off to university. Speaking about her experience navigating Hollywood's learning curve as a fresh-faced hopeful, Blunt explains, "It is a business that you enter into, especially as I did, and it appears to be made of rainbows and sunbeams. Then you realize it's called show business, because it is a business. I am not cynical in my personal life. I actually feel quite hopeful. But with the business itself, you have to approach it in a harder way. I think you have to wear a helmet. Ask what moment spurred this realization, Blunt chooses her words carefully. It was just an accumulation over the years. You are part of a machine that is moving, and will overwhelm you and drown you if you are not tough in it. It's a very precarious industry that can often be quite crushing, so any advice I have for anyone going into it is to do something else. There are other reasons to be wary of Hollywood, as attested by recent headlines about the gender wage gap and the deluge of sexual assault allegations. Ask whether she has been the victim of such harassment, Blunt says. Everyone has had their bum pinched, but I would not put me having my bum pinched on the same side of the street as women who have been raped or sexually assaulted or abused or harassed. Later, she clarifies, the bum pinch statement was more of a euphemism for any kind of minor behavior that I have experienced that has been very easy for me to shut down. I think it is something that everyone has experienced. That comment was meant in no way to disparage the people who have actually been brave enough to come forward. I think it is a really vital, remarkable time, and I really hope that it will translate to other social injustices, because I think this is a time when people are finding their voice and using it. As for negotiations in a wage-gap-conscious world, Blunt says, I took it on as my personal responsibility to make sure that I don't feel short-changed or less than. Especially in this new climate, I think that it's okay to reclaim the words making an aggressive deal as a positive. Usually, people are making so much money off your back that it comes down to a sort of justice thing for me. I make it a point to not be too concerned with I hope they think I'm a team player. The people who are calling and making the deals are business affairs. It's not the producer. It's people who are billed to F you up, to shortchange you. In a way, because we are inundated with those types of stories now, it has created a much safer climate to ask for what you want. Before filming Mary Poppins Returns last year, Blunt had a brief moment of cold sweat dread about succeeding an iconic person playing an iconic character. She quickly realized she needed her own spin to survive. No one can out Julie Andrews, so I had to do something that felt organic and representative of what I had taken from the books. Blunt says her interpretation of Mary is a bit more eccentric and frickin' weird. She is incredibly rude, vain, and batty. She really made me laugh. The actress also took a cue from Rosalind Russell's fast-talking, wise-cracking reporter in Howard Hawks' 1940 comedy His Girl Friday, which helped Blunt find her entry point into the character. Says Marshall of Blunt's Mary, she's like a hurricane when she arrives. Everybody's trying to catch up with her. Mary Poppins Returns is set 25 years after the original, when Mary returns to Cherry Tree Lane to help Michael, Ben Whishaw, his children, and his sister Jane, Emily Mortimer, after a family death. The film, featuring a score by Tony-winning composers Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman, also stars Lin-Manuel Miranda, Colin Firth, and Meryl Streep. Marking Blunt's third collaboration with Streep, following The Devil Wears Prada and Into the Woods. While filming in London, Blunt and her daughters lived a short drive from the actress's parents, who visited the set to cheer her on while she was filming big dance numbers. Julie Andrews, meanwhile, cheered Blunt on from afar, even politely turning down the possibility of a cameo. This is Emily's show, and I don't want to step on it in any way. I want her to run with it, Marshall remembers Andrews telling him. Blunt only recently showed the original to 3-year-old Hazel. She is besotted with this movie, says Blunt. To the point where I have a deep dread she is simply going to reject my version and be like, you are not Mary Poppins, because she is so in love with Julie Andrews, and she knows every single song. At first, she was kind of confused because I said, remember how Mummy was pretending to be Mary Poppins for a while? Well, there was another lady who played Mary Poppins. Would you like to see another Mary Poppins film? After wrapping Mary Poppins Returns, Blunt embarked on something entirely different, a supernatural thriller, A Quiet Place, which comes out in April, marks the first professional collaboration between Blunt and Krasinski, who directed, co-wrote, and co-stars in the film. I had concerns that we might kill each other, just gently throttle the life out of each other during the process, Blunt admits with a laugh. Krasinski received the script from Scott Beck and Brian Woods as a spec shortly after bringing Violet home from the hospital, and was struck by an idea to transform the story, with its minimal dialogue, into a metaphor for parenthood. Explains Krasinski, much of the sort of real-life roller coaster that is parenthood is unspoken. The first time you bring your kid home from the hospital, there's no talking. You just pray they're going to be okay. When you drop your kid off at school for the first time, there's no talking. You just pray they're going to be okay. So there's a familiar poignance and power to watching a family live in silence. That actually speaks volumes. Seeing Krasinski's excitement, Blunt encouraged him to direct the project, but neither party envisioned it being a marital collaboration. Blunt even suggested actresses she thought might be well suited for the female lead. Later, while reading Krasinski's draft, Blunt stopped cold. I had this overwhelming feeling of, I don't want anybody else to play this part, recalls Blunt. I said, would you feel weird if I did the movie with you? And he broke out into this sort of ecstatic smile. I felt completely sure about it in a way I hadn't before. It was a film that represented some of my deepest fears of not being able to protect my children. Krasinski says that witnessing his wife act in person was a totally different experience from watching her on screen. The air changes in the room when she starts doing what she does, he says. It's so honest and so pure and so powerful. It's like a superpower that she can just unlock and do so specifically with not many attempts. For me, I love acting, and I'm so lucky to be doing it, but she's on another plane. This weird intersection happened while filming where I totally forgot I was her husband. I was just watching her performance and was lucky enough to be in the front row. While Krasinski spends his days editing A Quiet Place, Blunt enjoys mommy duty, taking the girls to children's concerts in Brooklyn and teaching Hazel how to ride a scooter on the promenade. Making Mary Poppins Returns meant filming more than 12 hours a day. And while still bittersweet, raps have come to signify something greater than anything Blunt could have ever imagined 17 years ago, returning to her family. Good humor intact, Blunt even jokes about a fantasy career that wouldn't take her so far from home. It would be my dream just to flip houses, Blunt says. I adore renovating. I love working with different materials and coming up with a different story for each room. I am Pinterest mad. Another split second, then with a glint in her eye and a laugh, Blunt announces, once I begin playing everyone's mother, then I'll just start flipping houses instead.
Thank you.
The Other Harvey Scandal. Harvey Weinstein's alleged sexual predation has overshadowed another scandal. Did he bulldoze the leadership of AMFAR, the respected AIDS Research Foundation, into being part of a financial scheme? As federal prosecutors investigate, William D. Cohan discovers how, after two decades of star-studded Cannes fundraisers, AMFAR's most aggressive supporter pushed the charity too far, plunging its board into near civil war and exposing Weinstein's only true cause, himself. Opening photo, curtains, Harvey Weinstein at the L'Enfantin Theater, New York City, 2015. And in this photograph, Weinstein appears dressed in a suit with the burgundy-colored stage curtains in the background. Leonard Bernstein once observed that the definition of hell is an out-of-town tryout for a troubled musical bound for Broadway. He might add that an even deeper circle of hell is an out-of-town tryout for a troubled musical bound for Broadway and produced by Harvey Weinstein. While Weinstein is best known as a movie mogul and for his unconscionable behavior, he also has an extensive record of bringing shows to Broadway, including such hits as The Producers and Billy Elliot, as well as plenty of flops, such as Big Fish and Sweet Smell of Success. Most of his successful Broadway projects have been revivals: Gypsy, West Side Story, Wonderful Town, A Little Night Music, prompting a person who has worked with him to speculate that Weinstein is more comfortable tweaking established material, as he does when helping to edit a movie, than he is creating a show from scratch, where there is nearly an infinite number of possibilities to consider. That may have been part of the problem with his last Broadway outing, Finding Neverland, an original musical based on the 2004 Miramax film starring Johnny Depp and Kate Winslet, about the author J.M. Barrie's meeting a family whose children served as an inspiration for his classic book, Peter Pan and Kensington Gardens. I have been very hands-on from script to lyrics to music and casting, Harvey told the BBC before the show opened for a tryout in October 2012 in Leicester, England's Curve Theatre. In pretty much everything, director Rob Ashford and I are true partners, and I made that clear in the beginning. That's how I wanted to work, he added. Nevertheless, after the show premiered to tepid response, Weinstein fired the entire creative team and hired another one. Chief among the changes made was jettisoning a beautiful operatic score by Scott Frankel and Michael Corey, and replacing it with an anachronistic, more poppy score by Gary Barlow and Elliot Kennedy. The new version premiered in 2014 at the nonprofit American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It is affiliated with Harvard, and then opened at the L'Enfantin Theater on Broadway, where it had a respectable run of 565 performances. But the show never really found an audience or critical success, and closed in August 2016 without recouping its $15.2 million investment. Finding Neverland's creative travails made for much schadenfreude in the entertainment media, but an even more interesting story remained unexplored: the strange financial contortions Weinstein devised for the show. These transactionable financial transactions, these questionable financial transactions, have understandably been overshadowed by the allegations of his sexual misconduct. But in some ways, they are merely another manifestation of his grotesque impulse to bully, to manipulate, and to always have his way, regardless of the consequences. In any event, Prosecutors are now investigating whether Weinstein bulldozed the leadership of AMFAR, the respected Foundation for AIDS Research, into aiding and abetting a scheme to funnel some of a $2 million donation back to himself through the charity. Will prosecutors charge Weinstein for something unexpected like fraud, in the same way that gangster Al Capone got snagged for tax evasion? That's a question for the Southern District of New York to decide. But one thing is clear. Weinstein's relationship with AMFAR has thoroughly embarrassed the charity and hurt its $100 million capital campaign to find a cure for AIDS by 2020, while pushing the AMFAR Board of Directors into near civil war. Since its founding in 1985 as the American Foundation for AIDS Research, AMFAR has been a joint venture of the scientific and Hollywood communities. The latter lends its star power and financial support to AMFAR's scientific mission of finding a cure for AIDS. The charity's two founders, Dr. Matilda Krim, the Sloan Kettering scientist, and Hollywood legend Elizabeth Taylor, exemplified this partnership. It's kind of this fusion, says fashion designer Kenneth Cole, who has been chairman of the board of AMFAR for the past 13 years. That's the bridge I try to maintain. For the past two decades, Weinstein has been an integral part of AMFAR, helping to sponsor its star-studded annual gala at the Cannes Film Festival. The centerpiece of the evening is a charity auction that raises millions of dollars for AMFAR. Thanks to the intoxicating combination of freely flowing Cristal Rosé, the French Riviera in springtime, the presence of Hollywood celebrities, and the opportunity to support a worthy cause. In the 21 years we've been doing this, Weinstein said from the gala's podium in May 2014, we've raised $120 million. Every year, Weinstein would take as many as three tables and fill them with his glamorous Hollywood friends. Harvey usually had films showing at the festival in Cannes, and he would often bring the stars who were in town to our event, Cole says. He would also encourage investors and philanthropists he knew to come as well. His wealthy individuals would sit with his stars and starlets, and at the end of the day, the chemistry was good, and AMFAR was the beneficiary. For the May 2013 gala, Weinstein came up with the idea of auctioning off a pass to the various exclusive Hollywood parties given during Oscar week. Topped by invitations to the one hosted by Vanity Fair on the night of the award ceremony. That lot sold for $800,000, but the bidder never paid. Buying trouble. The following year, 2014, Weinstein tried again, but this time he wanted to split the proceeds from the Hollywood lot between AMFAR and two charities, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, and the American Repertory Theater, ART, where Finding Neverland was then in a tryout run prior to Broadway. The idea of splitting auction proceeds with other charities was plenty controversial inside AMFAR. According to an internal investigation, in May 2014, Andrew Boos, the independent contractor who ran the Cannes Gala, emailed Brad Thompson, then Weinstein's corporate PR man, with his concerns. AMFAR never does this, Boos wrote Thompson. The problem is that it takes money out of the room that we work so hard to put in the room. Many, many, many organizations approach us to secure a lot that we would split, and we never say yes. But Harvey Weinstein was not the type to take no for an answer, and AMFAR ultimately agreed to bend its policy to accommodate him. If Weinstein could get a second lot of Oscar party tickets, Amfar would agree to split those proceeds with Harvey's other charities. Honestly, Amfar CEO Kevin Frost wants to do this as a favor to Harvey, even though it is against Amfar policy, Boos wrote. Frost did not respond to request for an interview. Weinstein did secure the second lot, but somehow at the gala things got screwed up, and the lot was sold five times for around $140,000 each. We have not tried to collect these funds, Boos wrote Frost 2 months after the gala in July 2014, as we were waiting for TWC, the Weinstein Company, to tell us if they could fulfill more than two of these, which they have now told us they cannot. But Weinstein, in his inimitable style, as Boos put it, had a plan B. He wanted Amfar to go back to the five bidders to see if two of them would pay $420,000 each. Boos had his doubts. The hope is that two out of the five or six bidders will actually say yes to this, he wrote Frost. In addition, Weinstein now wanted 100% of the proceeds from the second lot to go to ART and UNHCR. Frost was also now ambivalent. When you approach these folks, and I honestly don't know how you're going to do that diplomatically, it should be made clear that you're acting under the instructions of Harvey Weinstein, he wrote. I really don't want this to blow back on Amfar. If, and only if, the second package sells, we would make it absolutely 100% clear to the buyer where the donation is going before they pay. In the end, neither lot sold at the higher price. The next year, in May 2015, Harvey tried again, with yet another new twist. By then, Finding Neverland was a month into its Broadway run at the Lunt-Fontanne Theater. Weinstein wanted to recoup some of the $2.05 million he had donated for the Cambridge production. The deal Weinstein cut with ART allowed him to get his money if he could get third parties to donate that sum to ART. It was a deal made in Harvey Heaven. To get some of the third-party money, Weinstein arranged for three lots to be sold at Amfar's May 2015 Cannes auction. One for a Hollywood experience, which included admission to the Oscar parties, plus a photo op with Bradley Cooper, and two lots for private photo sessions with the legendary fashion photographer Mario Testino, who is a contributing photographer for Vanity Fair. 2 weeks before the auction, according to an investigation report, Kenneth Cole told Frost that he had orally agreed to give Weinstein $600,000 from the proceeds of the three lots, assuming they sold for $1.2 million or more, as Weinstein predicted they would. All proceeds above $1.2 million would go to Amfar. Anything less than $1.2 million would be split equally. At the last minute, an insert printed for the gala program noted in small type that ART would get some of the proceeds from the two Testino photo shoots. No such notice accompanied the Hollywood Experience lot. At the May 2015 gala, Sanjay Hinduja, a recently married Indian billionaire, paid $245,824 for the Hollywood Experience. Lisa Giuliani, the wife of Italian pharmaceutical executive Mario Germano Giuliani, paid $381,100 for one of the Testino photography sessions. And Carrie Perotto, a billionaire French business executive, paid $282,775 for the other one. Even though the total take from the three auction lots was $909,699, well below the $1.2 million Weinstein anticipated, Weinstein still insisted on getting $600,000 for ART, leaving MFAR the balance of $310,000, according to accounting statements. Furthermore, Weinstein demanded that the $600,000 be paid to ART by June 1st, some 2 weeks later. Next, photos, star power, Weinstein, Jay-Z, Harvey Keitel, and Robert De Niro at the 2016 AMFAR New York Gala, Mario Testino and Lisa and Mario Germano Giuliani at AMFAR's Cinema Against AIDS Gala in Cap d'Antibes, France, 2015, Leonardo DiCaprio and Marion Cotillard at the same event in 2014, Weinstein and Heidi Klum at the 2014 Cannes Film Festival. Harvey's post-auction demand sent AMFAR into a tailspin. Frost informed Cole that AMFAR could not pay ART until the lots were actually fulfilled. "The latter is very important," Frost wrote, "since we can't actually book the money until the event happens." Since part of his package included the Vanity Fair party next February or March, whenever the Oscars are held, that would ordinarily be the earliest we could pay the money out. The same is true for the Mario Testino package. When Cole emailed Weinstein on May 26th to discuss Frost concerns, Weinstein suggested that the money for ART could come out of Lynn Blavatnik's pledge of $13.3 million for an unrelated lot, a Jeff Koons coloring book sculpture. The previous year, Blavatnik, the owner of Warner Music, had paid $15 million for a Damien Hirst sculpture of a woolly mammoth. "He's involved with us anyhow on a business level," Harvey observed. But Weinstein's suggestion seemed to have gone nowhere inside AMFAR. 3 days later, Weinstein was still insisting that AMFAR send $600,000 to ART by June 1st. In fact, Harvey's agreement with the theater had stipulated that it receive the promised third-party donations by that date, or the money given by Weinstein would not be returned to him and would be considered a donation to ART. In the end, Weinstein recouped all but around $100,000 of the $2.05 million he had given to ART. On May 29th, with the June 1st deadline looming, Weinstein and Cole had a conversation in the early evening, after which Charlie Prince, Weinstein's vice president for legal affairs, wrote Cole about a new idea Harvey had cooked up. On June 1st, Weinstein would wire $600,000 of his own money to AMFAR, which would then immediately wire it to ART. The theater would then repay the donations made by Harvey. Once the lots were collected, AMFAR would return the $600,000 to Weinstein. Kevin Frost was concerned that this new deal had not been properly vetted with AMFAR's auditor at Grant Thornton. On June 1st, Bradley Jensen, AMFAR's chief financial officer, contacted Grant Thornton to ask about its viability. The auditor replied that he needed at least a day to make sure it is okay to do and to provide the correct guidance. They should wait until tomorrow to be safe. But there was no time, apparently, for the auditor's review. Weinstein would not be thwarted. The internal investigation reports that at 3:46 p.m., he wired $600,000 to AMFAR. 17 minutes later, AMFAR wired $600,000 to ART. "I'm going on the record here to express my concerns about this whole process," Frost wrote Jensen. "Nothing about this deal feels right to me." But it was too late. The money had changed hands. Next photos. Foul play. The playbill for the New York production of Finding Neverland. Weinstein being honored at the MFAR New York Gala 2016. Gary Barlow, Matthew Morrison, Weinstein, Laura Michelle Kelly, and Kelsey Grammer take curtain calls on Finding Neverland's April 15, 2015 opening night on Broadway. Weinstein with attorney Lisa Bloom in New York City. Kenneth Cole and Weinstein at AMFAR's Cinema Against AIDS Gala in Mougins, France, 2005. Here's the deal. Why had Cole agreed to this questionable transaction? In search of an answer, I met him at the headquarters of his fashion business, Kenneth Cole Productions, in Manhattan. It's an old carriage house, beautifully restored, with exposed brick and wood beams. Ruggedly handsome and stylishly dressed, Cole led me to a conference room overlooking the Hudson River. He seemed jittery. His voice was raspy as he told me that this was the first time he had spoken extensively about the MFAR deal with Weinstein. He wanted to get a few things off his chest right from the start. "Harvey was a bully," he said. "We were never friends. I never looked forward to a single encounter with him." As we came to learn later, Harvey was clearly not only abusive to women in despicable ways, but I assume he was also abusive to everybody he did business with. He would always look to get more than he was entitled to. That being said, I was okay with it if the benefit to AMFAR and our cure initiative continued to outweigh the cost of doing business with him, assuming also, of course, that it was within our governance guidelines. He also wanted to make clear that he was the non-executive chairman of AMFAR and always had been. He relied on the AMFAR management to run the organization day to day, as well as its various fundraising events, which occurred each year around the world. He said he was just a middleman, trying to balance a variety of powerful interest. "Harvey's a big, important fundraiser," he told me. "How do we get Harvey to a place where he feels good about it? How do we get AMFAR to a place where it benefits to the degree that it can within the boundaries it defines? And that's kind of that tricky place as a business person that I try to play. And it's a hard role, but it's a non-executive role." He explained that he found out about Weinstein's desire to split the proceeds from the winning bids for the three lots between AMFAR and ART only a day or two before the May 2015 gala. But what he did for Harvey, including slipping the insert into the auction catalog at the last minute, seemed like subterfuge. "Harvey was a bully," Cole repeated by way of an explanation. What made it worse is that Harvey also had a terrible temper. He was like a volcano that you knew would periodically erupt, and you just hoped that you weren't nearby when it did. Cole said he got more involved in the controversy only after Weinstein demanded the $600,000 be paid to ART by June 1st. But Cole didn't ask him why. "Yeah, in retrospect, we should have asked him," Cole said. As part of his negotiation with Weinstein, Cole got him to commit to being honored at the February 2016 MFAR Gala in New York, which Cole thought would generate an additional $1 million for the organization. The plot thickened over the summer of 2015, when at the request of John Simmons, the chairman of the board's audit committee, AMFAR executives began drafting an agreement to repay Weinstein his $600,000 when the lots were fulfilled, in keeping with AMFAR's policy. Again, Weinstein made it clear he didn't care about AMFAR's policies and wanted his money back immediately. According to the internal report, Frost wrote to Cole on July 17th that, "You know my views on this." So Charlie Prince, Weinstein's legal man proposed a different solution. Amfar would repay Weinstein's money immediately, and Weinstein would agree to indemnify Amfar in the event that any of the lots weren't fulfilled down the road. Right, Frost deadpanned. But Cole overruled him. It is what we agreed, he wrote Frost. A frustrated Frost wrote Simmons, the audit committee chair, about Cole. I don't even know what to say to Kenneth at this point. I did not and would not agree to these terms. I'm not willing to go along. How should I proceed? John Simons declined to comment for this story. Again, Cole forced Frost's hand. On August 24th, Amfar acceded to Weinstein's wishes. In a 3-page signed contract, Weinstein agreed to indemnify Amfar against any losses from the lots, as long as his $600,000 was repaid immediately. On September 1st, Weinstein got his money back. Shouldn't the bizarre transaction with Weinstein have raised a red flag? It raised a flag, but everything Harvey does raises a flag, Cole said. There were caveats attached to everything he did. Was Harvey more trouble than he was worth? In retrospect, yes, Cole answered. None of this is worth it. We would make compromises to help raise precious funds to save our vital mission. But not if it meant compromising our integrity to do it. That being said, we had been assured by counsel that all that was being done was legal, ethical, and not without precedent. Treading the board. That still was not the end of the saga. Soon after Amfar's February 2016 gala honoring Weinstein, a special committee of the Amfar board hired Tom Ajami, a respected litigator with practices in New York and Houston, to investigate the Weinstein transactions. In his September 2016 report, Ajami recounted 14 unsuccessful attempts to speak with Weinstein. He concluded that the transaction exposed Amfar to material risk to its financial integrity and reputation, and that because Weinstein refused to disclose any of the material facts about it, Amfar had no way of determining whether there was any danger. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.